This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We all know that plastics are common in modern life, but our guest Susan Frankel says they're really everywhere in our toothbrushes, hair dryers, cell phones, computers, doorknobs, car parts, and of course in those ubiquitous plastic bags we get just about every time we buy anything. They're made from polyethylene, the most common type of plastic in use today. By one estimate, the amount of polyethylene produced in America every year is nearly equal to the combined mass of every man, woman, and child in the country. Frankel's new book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, chronicles the rise of plastics in consumer culture and its effects on the environment and our health. For example, she notes that plastics have had enormously beneficial effects, like making blood transfusions safe and common, but scientists are also finding that chemicals from blood and IV bags are leaching into the fluids we take into our bodies. Susan Frankel is a science writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Discover, Smithsonian, and other publications. She spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Susan Frankel, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's begin with the little experiment that you describe at the beginning of your book. You were going to spend a day without touching plastic, right? What happened?
Right. I didn't think through the idea very hard, which is why I walked into the bathroom that morning and looked down and there is my plastic toilet seat. So I had to change my plan. And instead of spending the day not touching anything plastic, I decided I would spend the day writing down everything I touched that was plastic. And by the end of the day, my notebook was filled with pages and pages of plastic things. Things that I went into the experiment knowing were plastic, you know, like the sandwich bags, but then things I never imagined were plastic, like the doorknob of my front door, which I thought was brass, but when I looked closely, I realized was plastic. I didn't really understand how my life had become so permeated by plastic, and I realized I didn't know the first thing about this stuff. I didn't know what plastic was, where it came from, or whether there were reasons to be concerned about it. And I figured if I was asking those questions, probably other people were too.
Give us a layman's understanding of what plastic is chemically.
Well, you know, we talk about plastic like it's one thing, but plastic is really – plastics are a huge family of materials. There are thousands of different plastics, and in many ways they're as different from one another as paper can be from glass. So in plastic, I call them daisy chains. They're giant molecules that are hooked together like daisy chains. And another way to imagine them is like a string of beads. And how those beads are arranged, what the beads actually are, how they're strung on that string, how the strings are arranged with one another can affect what a plastic looks like, how it behaves, how it feels. What these all have in common, though, is that they're polymers. They're these gigantic molecules, these long daisy chains. And as I said, you can get them having very different properties. So take, for instance, something like nylon. You know, nylon can be stretchy, like in pantyhose. It can be silky, like a parachute. It can be bristly, like the end of your toothbrush. Or it can be a solid, smooth material, like the wheels of a roller skate, or bushy, like Velcro. You know, plastic has this kind of pejorative connotation, but it's pretty amazing that we've managed to make this family of materials that has so many different properties and that we can engineer kind of to do and be exactly what we want them to be.
Now, why was the development of plastics driven in part by the oil industry?
Well, plastics come from the byproducts that are produced in the refining of oil or the processing of natural gas. Actually, in this country, most plastics come from natural gas. And those processes throw off these byproducts, which, you know, could just be wasted. But really, since the early 20th century, the petroleum and chemical industries got very good at taking these byproducts and reprocessing them, in a sense, to create new products like raw plastics.
Can you give us an example of a byproduct of oil refining that led to a plastic?
Sure. You know, I'll give you the example of ethylene, which is a byproduct of oil refining. There is a sort of legend that Nelson Rockefeller, founder of Standard Oil, was looking out over his, you know, vast refinery complex and saw flares burning off some gas. And he said, you know, what is that? What is that that we're burning off? And somebody said, well, that's ethane. And he said, ethane, which is a precursor to ethylene. Well, I don't want to waste that. I don't want to waste anything. And, you know, the, you know, let's figure out something to do with it. And that something turned out to be ethylene, which is now used to make polyethylene.
And so what did they do? You have a gas that's being vented from the stack of a refinery. Is it captured and then cooled so that it becomes a liquid and then, what, turned into a plastic resin or something?
Well, that makes it sound like a really simple process. And, you know, when I went to go visit Dow Chemical's polyethylene plant in Freeport, Texas, that very simple process that you just described takes place over miles and miles of pipes stretching out over acres. Basically, what happens is the ethylene is piped in a series of pipes and subjected to different ranges of pressures and temperatures, and different other gases are fed in with it. And eventually, they all go into this thing called the reactor, which I had envisioned was going to be like some lab with, you know, bubbling flasks and vats, but actually was this huge two-story room with these gigantic pipes looping up and down floor to ceiling. And at the start of that room where the gases first go in, they go in at the start of the room, and then other chemicals are fed in to trigger a chemical reaction that will cause the gases to hook together into these daisy chains and become liquid, and out the other end comes polyethylene. I couldn't see any of that, but I was walking along the outside of the reactor chamber, and all of a sudden I realized I smelled plastic. It was like sticking my nose in the, you know, in an empty bottle of milk or a jug of milk. And then I looked around on the floor and suddenly I could see these little clumps of this waxy white stuff that was raw polyethylene.
So just to simplify it to the beginning and the end, or this gas that's being thrown off by a refinery is turned into what? What is it used for?
The gas is turned into essentially liquid plastic that then is extruded into tiny little pellets that look like rice grains. And those are sort of the raw material from which plastic products are made.
And which plastic products come from, is it polyethylene?
In this case, I was looking at polyethylene, but this is more or less the process for all kinds of plastics. They start with gases. Chemical reactions take place that turn them into these polymers, these giant molecules that are liquid. And what comes out are pellets or powders that are sent out from the Dow and other companies that make, they call them resins, raw plastics, and those are shipped out to, you know, manufacturers and processors around the world, really, who then turn them into plastic stuff.
You say the dawn of the age of plastics was 1941. Why?
What happened in 1941 is that the guy who was in charge of provisioning the U.S. military at the outset of World War II started requisitioning plastic to replace strategic metals that were really needed. And that led to a huge ramping up of plastics production. A lot of plastics had been discovered and invented in the 20s and 30s, but hadn't really made their way into major production. And it was kind of the military needs of the war that got those plastics going strong.
And what military supplies were they used to make?
Oh, wide range. I mean, from, you know, the basic standard issue combs that GIs got, which up until that time had been made from rubber, to, you know, mortar fuses, to the acrylic turrets that were used on planes for gunners. They were throughout the military, plastic bugles.
Huh. And then after the war, you had this more developed plastics industry, and it needed a market, right?
Exactly. You know, imagine all of these all of these manufacturers with these huge built-up supplies of plastic and huge capacity, and they needed to do something with it.
Now, one of the things that I like about your book is that it isn't just about, you know, the dangers and toxic effects of plastics, but the ways in which they have enriched the lives of a lot of Americans. Describe ways in which plastics, in effect, democratized, had a democratizing impact on American life.
Well, that was something that started really early on with plastics. And I tell the story of the comb as an example of that. Now, combs in the mid-19th century were often made from things like tortoiseshell or ivory. But by the mid-19th century, people were beginning to get worried that both ivory and tortoiseshell were becoming in short supply because the animals were being sort of hunted into extinction. And that actually was a goad to the development of early plastics. One of the big uses of ivory was for billiard balls. And a billiard ball manufacturer in the 1860s put out an ad offering $10,000 for anybody who could come up with a viable substitute for ivory. That ad caught the eye of an inventor in New York named John Wesley Hyatt, who was kind of an amateur inventor. And he started looking at ways to develop an adequate substitute. And what he actually ended up coming up with was the early plastic celluloid, which was made from cellulose, actually from cotton. And one of the first uses or common uses for celluloid was combs, because you could take celluloid and make it look like any kind of valuable material. It was really good. It was very easy to make it look like tortoiseshell or to make it look like ivory. And indeed, that was what was done. And so you had sort of these exquisite combs that looked like they'd come, you know, from tortoiseshell or ivory. It looked like they'd cost a fortune, but actually, you know, you could get them for quite cheap and anybody could have one.
And then, you know, once plastics became much more ubiquitous, you had consumers that suddenly now they could get cheap combs, they could get a cheap toothbrush, they could buy a suitcase that was light and strong, they could have clear packaging that could wrap food and allow them to see whether or not it was fresh. There was fishing line, all this stuff. How did we feel about plastic? Did we embrace this artificial stuff, or were we suspicious of it at first?
In the early days, people were enthralled. I mean, imagine something like cellophane, this clear material. People loved cellophane so much that in the 40s, the word itself was considered the third most beautiful in the English language after mother and memory. I think, you know, people continued to love it until they started seeing it being increasingly used for schlocky kinds of things, like, you know, lawn flamingos. There was a fiasco in the early 60s when DuPont tried to develop a synthetic leather Corfam and, you know, touted it as good as leather, but, you know, it really didn't work very well. And so, you know, by the time I was growing up in the 70s, plastic had pretty much become a cultural joke. It was the punchline to the movie The Graduate. You know, when I was writing this book, almost every single person who I told I was working on a book about plastic invariably mentioned that line. You know, 40 years later, it still resonates.
You take us through some commonly manufactured plastic items, like the single form chair, of which there are probably billions made and sold cheaply. The Frisbee is another one you write about. But I wanted to talk about some of the uses in medicine. And it was interesting that it had a powerful effect on modern medicine, right? I mean, it really allowed scientists to do things that they couldn't do before.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, plastic, you couldn't have modern medicine without plastic. You know, going back to in the 40s when William Kolff invented the first kidney dialysis machine using cellophane, in fact, and said, you know, what God didn't grow, man can make. I was reminded that recently when my mother broke her hip and I was with her in the hospital and looking all around at all of the plastics in her room, from, you know, the machinery monitoring her oxygen levels to the actual replacement hip in her body.
Explain the effect of plastics on the ability to transfuse blood and store blood.
Okay, I tell the story of the blood bag, and I chose that object because it's made out of vinyl, and it was something that I think perfectly kind of illustrates the benefits and problems of plastic in medicine. Blood, up until the 50s, really, to the extent that blood collection took place, it was in glass bottles. If you went to get blood drawn, up until the 1950s, you know, they would use a steel needle, and the blood would be taken out through that needle, through rubber tubing, into a glass bottle with a rubber stopper. It didn't work very well. The blood cells were damaged in the process, and of course, those glass bottles were breakable. It wasn't a great system. And in the 1950s, a Boston surgeon named Carl Walter started looking for a better way, and he came up with the idea of using one of the new plastics that was out, vinyl, as a way to collect and store blood. And he invented the vinyl blood bag. And in fact, you know, to prove its advantages to colleagues, he took it with him to a meeting filled with blood and stepped on it to show them, you know, this is really unbreakable. And it was a huge technical advantage. You know, you had bottles not only that wouldn't break, but they made it possible to store blood more safely, to collect it more safely, and to separate out the components in a sort of sterile, secure fashion. So that a single unit of blood could go, instead of just going to one patient, could go to three. So it was a great, great development.
And the final tubing that was used for IVs and all kinds of other procedures, that was better than rubber?
That was better than rubber. And it was seen at the time as not only, you know, it was considered better than rubber, and it was considered inert. People assumed that this was stuff that wasn't going to cause any problem to human health.
Now, what are some of the issues that have arisen with the use of vinyl blood bags and IV tubes?
Well, vinyl, the plastic vinyl, PVC, is made from a plastic called PVC. And on its own, PVC is a pretty rigid and brittle plastic. The way that you make it into something soft and pliable that you can use for, say, a blood bag or an IV bag is by adding in these sort of oily chemicals called phthalates, and in particular one called DEHP. The problem is that DEHP doesn't really bond with the plastic. And it's, remember I compared earlier plastic, a polymer, to a long strand. Well, imagine those long strands, and then the DEHP is like little snips of spaghetti, say. It comes out really easily, and it leaches out easily. It leaches into the blood that's contained in the blood bag. It particularly will leach out if there's a fatty liquid present. But we've known since the early 70s that DEHP leaches out of vinyl. And the way that we know is that there were a pair of scientists at that time who were doing some experiments with rat livers. It doesn't really matter what they were trying to do. But they kept finding this weird, strange compound that was fouling up their experiments. And when they set out to figure out what it was, they discovered it was DEHP. And they were very surprised because everybody had assumed that this is, you know, an inert material. They then did a bunch of research and, you know, they came to the conclusion that this was not harmful, that this was fine for human health, except under some very, very particular and rare circumstances. Fast forward about 20 years, in the late 90s, our understanding about sort of toxicology has changed, and a couple of things had happened. One is that there was sort of a new science discovering that some chemicals don't work like traditional toxins. They, instead of sort of there being kind of a straight line of exposure to something like, you know, birth defects or cancer, these chemicals act in a sort of more convoluted and complicated way. They interfere with our hormones and they interfere with the endocrine system, which is the network of glands that orchestrate growth and development. And there was some research done showing that DEHP, this chemical that's in vinyl, has this property. It's interferes with testosterone. Most people aren't exposed to those kinds of levels, even in hospital settings where you are, you know, being transfused for a long time or a little baby is being transfused for a long time. It's not approaching those levels. It is more subtle, probably. But we don't know what the safe level is.
All right. So then these materials that we've been using, you know, everywhere for blood bags and for IV solutions and for tubes, there might be some concerns about them. Are there alternatives that people are exploring?
There are alternatives. There's kind of actually, it's a huge and growing area. And that's the irony and frustrating thing to me, to be honest. Vinyl, polyvinyl chloride, there are alternatives for that in medicine. And there are actually companies who are using them. B. Braun, for instance, went into the market with the deliberate mission of finding alternative materials. So they make IV bags and tubes out of things like polyethylene and polypropylene or silicone tubes. The problem is these are more expensive. And so for cash-strapped hospitals, you can understand why they may be reluctant to go with an alternative when they don't even completely know whether it's okay.
Well, what's been the reaction of the chemical industry to these critiques of vinyl bags and tubes?
You know, the chemical industry basically maintains that this stuff is safe. The argument about phthalates, for instance, is they've been in use for 50 years. There's no evidence of widespread human problems, and therefore, what's the issue? And, you know, the vinyl industry has its own trade association, which rebuts studies. The American Chemistry Council is very quick to rebut any negative studies that come out. And, you know, they are right. The science on this is still uncertain. It is still evolving. We are looking at a whole new world of risks. But, you know, I talked to one researcher who pointed out that, you know, there are similarities between the way the chemical industry responds to a lot of the studies that are suggesting problems and the way the tobacco industry defended tobacco for 50 years. You know, it's hard to make a slam dunk showing that these things are dangerous. You make that case through epidemiological studies and through animal studies, and, you know, if you very carefully piece it together. Anytime you get a epidemiological study suggesting a correlation between exposure to a phthalate or bisphenol A, for instance, and a health outcome, the chemical industry quickly points out that this is just a correlation. There's no evidence of direct cause and effect. That's true. That's what epidemiological studies do, but they are the gold standard for determining public health hazards. And this was the same strategy that was used by the tobacco companies when they were trying to fight growing evidence that tobacco causes lung cancer. It's been called the strategy of sowing doubt.
What's the state of government regulation of plastics and their potential health effects?
Unlike pesticides or drugs, there's no real explicit government regulation of plastics. We have a very fragmented and fairly ineffective patchwork of laws to regulate synthetic chemicals. The central regulation there is something called the Toxic Substances Control Act, which was passed in 1976. People's criticisms of that law are that it has tended to treat chemicals as safe until proven to be dangerous. But the way that the law is written, it's very difficult to establish that a chemical is dangerous because manufacturers do not have to volunteer information about that, and the EPA is, the Environmental Protection Agency, is fairly hamstrung in its ability to collect information.
So of all the thousands of different kinds of plastics in all of their many, many different uses, I mean, how secure should we feel that somebody's looking out to see whether it's hurting us?
I think it depends on how worried you want to be. Look, I you know, there are a lot of plastics out there. Plastics are not created equal, and I think there are a lot of plastics that we don't have to worry about. I'm not so worried about polyethylene. I'm not particularly worried about polypropylene, which is the stuff that's used, the plastic that's used in like yogurt containers or margarine tubs.
And you mentioned polyethylene. That's what the
polyethylene. That's the stuff of like plastic baggies.
The grocery bags, right? Yeah.
Grocery bags. Yeah, sort of a film, that thin film plastic. But we know that hazardous chemicals are used in plastics, and we know that some of those plastics will leach chemicals that may be harmful to our health. And we don't know the full extent of that. I'll give you an example, which is PET, polyethylene terephthalate. It's the plastic that's used in soda bottles and water bottles, another plastic that we have for decades considered an inert plastic. Well, in recent years, there have been several studies showing that PET can leach some kind of compound that seems to have estrogenic activity, that seems to act like an estrogen. We don't know what that compound is. We don't know whether it's being leached in sufficient quantities to have any impact on human health. The fact that we're suddenly discovering it is a little disconcerting. You know, that said, I think those kinds of findings are why we need to have stronger laws that require manufacturers to demonstrate the safety of the chemicals that they put into commerce, because we don't want to be finding these things out decades after the fact.
So the basic difference is, if you want to market a new pharmaceutical, you need to demonstrate its safety. You have to test it. If you want to put a new plastic product out, you put it out and then wait to see if somebody figures out there might be a problem.
Exactly. I mean, when plastics came bursting onto the scene, the presumption was that these were inert materials. And what we're finding is that they may actually be much more biologically active in some cases than we ever imagined.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with writer Susan Frankel. She's written a new book about the presence and effects of plastic in our lives. It's called Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. Have there been problems with plastics leaching from baby bottles?
The plastic that used to be used to make baby bottles is polycarbonate. It's a hard, clear, glass-like plastic. And one of the main ingredients in that is a chemical called bisphenol A, which is an estrogen mimic. If you look at a diagram of that molecule, it looks just like an estrogen molecule. And bisphenol A has been associated with a bunch of health problems, including obesity, breast cancer, heart disease, and others. And so, you know, when research about bisphenol A started coming out, you know, people, parents especially, were understandably horrified at the thought that the bottles that they were using to feed their babies could potentially be leaching this chemical into their babies. You'd be hard-pressed to buy a baby bottle now that contains BPA. You know, this is one of those instances where the government didn't step in, but Walmart did. And, you know, the big box stores won't carry BPA bottles. I actually was in San Diego a couple of years ago and saw this display of sports water bottles, which also used to be made of polycarbonate. And they were these things that usually cost like $15 were marked down to $1 because they still had bisphenol A in them.
So this is a case where concerns were raised about health issues associated with bisphenol A, and it became such a publicly known issue that retailers responded, but there was no regulatory authority that stepped in and did anything?
No. Bisphenol A is still manufacturers are still free to use bisphenol A, although it's acquired such a bad rep that not many do. But yeah, this is one of those cases. Now, and you know, there are other countries. There are some states, and I don't know the exact number. There are some states that have outlawed bisphenol A, and there are some countries that have said it can't be used in products that are being used by children. The problem, of course, is, you know, you end up with this sort of patchwork of regulations and no consistency or guarantee.
You know, your book is called Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, and you maintain this metaphor throughout it of our relationship with plastic, and it's clear we're not going to break up. There are just too many things that we use. But at the end of the book, there's this really troubling set of statistics you offer, that we have produced nearly as much plastic in the last 10 years as in all of the previous decades combined. Plastic production is accelerating. Plastic goods are spilling out across the landscape. A culture of use and dispose is being exported to a developing world. You say plastic production could reach 2 trillion pounds a year by 2050, 4 times today's levels. This is just kind of depressing, isn't it? I mean, is there a way to produce and use less of this stuff?
I think there is. I think that we are going to have to. I mean, part of the reason you're looking at 2 trillion pounds is that we're exporting not just, you know, good plastic consumer goods and to the developing countries, but also a kind of throwaway culture. And that's really what we have to get away from. Half of the plastics made now are for throwaway items. And that is the biggest and sort of most troubling use of plastic, because a lot of those are just trivial things that we don't need and which, you know, end up in swaths of the world's oceans. I think that the changes that are going to have to take place in the way that we deal with plastic are changes that are going to have to come from everyone with a stake in the future of plastics. So that means, you know, manufacturers are going to have to be thinking more carefully about the way they make plastics, the chemicals that are used in them, the kinds of applications they have. And we as consumers have to take responsibility and look more carefully and thoughtfully at the way that we use plastics.
Well, Susan Frankel, it's been interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Susan Frankel spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Her new book is called Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward reviews the new box set, The Bristol Sessions, 1927-28. The Sessions gave Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family their commercial debuts. This is Fresh Air. In 1927 and 1928, Ralph Peer, a talent scout for the Victor Talking Machine Company, set up recording sessions in Bristol, a town which straddles the Tennessee and Virginia borders. The result was essentially the birth of country music, rock historian Ed Ward explains.
I love my Lula Bell, I do, yes, I do. I love my Lula Bell, I do, yes, I do. I love my Lula Bell, I do, yes, I do. But I don't expect to see her anymore.
The Victor Company will have a recording machine in Bristol for 10 days beginning Monday to record records, inquired our store. That was the text in a small box that appeared in the Bristol News Bulletin on July 24, 1927. 3 days later, one of the paper's reporters sat in on a recording session where Ralph Peer cut a few sides on Ernest Stoneman and his family. The Stonemans were locals, well known in Bristol, and had a successful career with Victor. He received from the company $3,600 last year as his share of the proceeds on his records, the story said. In other words, about 3.5 times the average national wage. That did it. Starting at 9 on the morning of July 28th, musicians by the score showed up at the Taylor Christian Hat Company building on State Street, Virginia on its north side, Tennessee on the south side, and waited for their chance. The first soon-to-be-famous name to step in front of the microphone was Blind Alfred Reed, a fiddler who would later record the classic How Can a Poor Man Stand Such Times and Live? But aside from a train wreck ballad, he recorded sacred material.
Be denied, you must unload, you must unload. You're robbing God's own treasury to feed yourself in pride. You must unload. The way is straight and narrow, and but few are in the road. My brother and my sister, is there no other road? If you want to get to heaven, your future.
Peer must have figured the rural market wanted white gospel music because he sure recorded a lot in Bristol. One of his favorites, and mine, is the very formal-sounding Alfred G. Carnes, who had just bought a Gibson harp guitar for $375 to accompany himself.
In the foreign heathen country where the people know not God, I am going there to preach his precious word. Where they bow to worship idols, I am going there to stay. Where I'll labor in the vineyard of the Lord. I'll soon be with my loved ones in my happy heavenly home. Even now the thought my soul with rapture thrills. So goodbye, my friends and brethren, for the time has come to go. I must leave you on the dear old battlefield. I am called a
But Stoneman and his friends and family had also shown Peer the traditional music sold, so J.P. Nestor and Norman Edmonds got their chance, too, and recorded a classic.
Train on, I don't see that yet is creel. Go tell my true love, but can't roll the wheel. I can't roll the wheel, but I can't roll the wheel. Train on, I don't see that yet it blow. Go tell my true love, sick and I can't go. Sick and I can't go.
Nobody seems to know what the lyrics to Train on the Island mean, but picking like that, who cares? Nestor and Edmonds led off Monday, August 1st sessions at 12:30, but at 5:30, two women and a man stepped into the room, and everything changed.
Under the weeping willow, yes, under the anything will obtain. So he may know where I am sleeping, and perhaps he will weep for me.
A.P. Carter, his wife Sarah, and Sarah's teenage sister Maybelle Addington were from the surrounding countryside in Macy Springs, Virginia, and Pierre knew he had struck gold, especially when Maybelle and Sarah came back the next morning and cut two duets. The Carter family, as they called themselves, became one of the biggest acts in America, continuing on in this original form until 1942. Lightning struck again on Thursday the 4th. The Tenever Ramblers were four young men who had been working out of Asheville, North Carolina, whom Pierre had encouraged to audition. Nobody's sure just what happened, but by the time Thursday came around, their lead singer had left them and recorded two songs by himself.
Sleep, baby, sleepy. Oh, listen to your mother, dear, sing these lullabies. Deep, baby, sleepy, while angels watch over you. Listen.
Tuberculosis would kill Jimmy Rogers 5 years later, but he probably sold more records for Victor than any artist before Elvis. And yes, the Tenever Ramblers got their chance later that afternoon, but they don't sound very special. Pierre packed up his equipment and took his masters with him to Camden, New Jersey, to start pressing the many keepers he'd recorded. He returned to Bristol the next year, between October 27th and November 4th, 1928. His only major find this time was the Stamps Quartet, whose Come to the Savior sold 13,792 copies, the most of any of the Bristol recordings. The Stamps, in one form or another, continued through 1980 and counted Elvis Presley as a major fan. But my favorite from the 1928 sessions was the wonderfully named Shortbuckle Rourke and Family, who concluded Ralph Peer's epic act of discovery with a classic.
I wish to the Lord I'd never been born or died when I was young. I never would have seen them two brown eyes or heard that clattering tongue, my lover, heard that clattering tongue. I truly understand that you love another man, and your heart shall no longer be mine. Who will shoe your little feet? Who will glove your hands? Who will kiss your red rose cheeks when I'm in the foreign land, my love, when I'm in the foreign land? I truly understand that you love another man, and your heart shall no longer be mine.
Ed Ward reviewed the Bristol Sessions, 1927 to 1928, on Bear Family Records. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews Mary Gordon's new novel, The Love of My Youth. This is Fresh Air. Novelist and memoirist Mary Gordon is known for her clear-eyed writing on such themes as guilt, the shakiness of personal identity, feminism, and Catholicism. But critic Maureen Carrigan says that most of those themes resurface in Gordon's new novel, The Love of My Youth, which also serves up nourishing portions of nostalgia and good pasta. Here's her review.
To fully give yourself over to Mary Gordon's luscious, wistful new novel, you've first got to make yourself forget that the internet exists. Let me explain. Gordon's novel, called The Love of My Youth, opens in Rome in 2007. The premise is that two former lovers, Americans named Adam and Miranda, who haven't seen each other in nearly 40 years, are brought together for a dinner party at the flat of a mutual friend. Adam and Miranda fell in love at 16 and remained together throughout college and beyond. This was the real deal. The two were going to be married, have children together. until Adam, in a bumbling move whose exact details we readers don't find out about until the end of the novel, betrayed Miranda and they parted. They've each gone on and lived their lives, had solid careers, married other people, spawned children who are now themselves adults. When fate throws the ex-lovers together again in Rome, they're pushing 60. And neither of them has ever once trolled the internet to find out whatever happened to the person who was once the passionate center of his/her life? I suppose it's possible. Adam and Miranda are better, more dignified people than most of us are. In the privacy of their home offices, during downtime at work, they do not Google. If you can muzzle your skepticism on this matter, The Love of My Youth is an enchanting read, a travelogue through time as well as through some of Rome's most beautiful spaces. Gordon's novel dangles out the fantasy of the faultlessly executed second chance. It's a testament to Gordon's sure touch as a writer that she manages to set up the cumbersome pretext of the aging ex-lover's reunion with as little clanking and hammering as possible. The mature Miranda is an epidemiologist. She's in Rome, conveniently sans husband, for a 3-week conference. Adam, a music teacher, is there chaperoning his 18-year-old daughter, a violin prodigy. After that reunion dinner, Adam, whose Italian-American family hailed from Rome, proposes that they meet for a few hours every day so he can show Miranda some gorgeous Roman locale the tourists haven't totally mobbed. What gal could refuse such an extended act of expiation? And so begins a time out of time, where Miranda and Adam stroll the Villa Borghese and nestle into cafes, while the book itself shifts into a light novel of ideas. The pair talk about mortality and concepts of identity. Thankfully, all the talk isn't so highfalutin. Here are snatches of a long passage where Miranda opens up to Adam about what it's like for a woman to enter what she calls the age of embarrassment. What a strange thing it is, embarrassment, so powerful, yet no one acknowledges it as one of the important human states. And it's so physical. Think of hair color. You have to do it well, because if it's done badly, everyone has to feel sorry for you having to dye your hair. And you have to avoid dyeing it certain colors so that it appears that you're pretending not to dye it, or that you're making a joke of yourself by acknowledging too loudly that it's fake. More than anything, though, I fear being thought of as a game girl. Those women traveling around in groups wearing red hats, or maybe they're purple hats. Better subtle, neutral shades, blacks, taupes, a bit of mourning for the end of youth is called for. As you can hear, Miranda is the judgmental one, Adam the quiet listener. Personality differences whose fatal implications become more telling through Gordon's evocative flashbacks to the couple's shared youth during the 1960s. The Love of My Youth has all the undeniable appeal and the contrivance of that perennial PBS Britcom as time goes by, a show whose premise is also hard to imagine in the internet age. But much more is at stake in Gordon's novel than the will-they-or-won't-they suspense of a possible holiday hookup. Gordon's characters explore the hard costs of changing, maturing. They share the dazed epiphany of late middle age, namely, that it takes so long to grow up and then you die. Readers may well feel that same shock at the end of The Love of My Youth. It takes a while to settle into Gordon's world here, and then it's all over much too quickly.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Love of My Youth by Mary Gordon. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. John Sheehan directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.